Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today's episode has been sponsored by Jay McLaughlin. Jay McLaughlin is a timeless lifestyle brand with incredible style and a spirit of connection. I am obsessed with Jay McLaughlin and have been so honored that they are sponsoring my Zibbyverse tour. It just so happens that the tour goes to so many communities and areas of the country that have Jay McLaughlin stores. And I love that the brand is philanthropic through Jay McLaughlin's
local and loyal programming.
Host store events to give back to organizations that are meaningful to Jay McLaughlin's local communities. I also love the fact that the clothes are just so chic. They make me feel polished and modern. And the best part is that most of the line comes in fabrics that don't wrinkle. I especially love the dresses, the cashmere sweaters, the other sweaters. You'll see them all over my Instagram. I typically tag at Jay McLaughlin. And so you can check it out. It is absolutely one of my favorite brands, and I am over the moon excited to be working with them. In fact, I want to share the love with all of you. Jay McLaughlin is giving 20% off new customers and listeners of my podcast with special code ZIBBY20. Capital ZIBBY 20. That's 20% off for new customers and listeners of the podcast with special code capital ZIBBY20. Take advantage of it today. My favorites are this white, open, long cashmere sweater that I've been wearing on every flight that I've taken on this tour. I have a blue with light blue horizontal striped sweater, several dresses I even wore on Good Morning America. Check it out, Jay McLaughlin. Thanks so much. Welcome to Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books with Zibby. I'm the host, Zibby Owens. I am an author. My latest is Blank, pub date March 1st, a novel. I'm also a podcaster, obviously, a publisher, a bookstore owner, and so much more. If you love books, you're in the right place. In fact, we call it the Zibbyverse, or really, the LA Times called it the Zibbyverse, and we're going with it. Go to ZibbyOwens.com to learn more and follow me on Instagram at Zibby Owens. Roxana Robinson is the author of 10 books, including 6 novels, 3 short story collections, and the biography of Georgia O'Keeffe. 4 of these were New York Times notable books. Robinson was born in Kentucky, but grew up in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. She attended Bennington College and graduated from the University of Michigan. She worked in the art world, specializing in the field of American painting, before she began writing full-time. Her novel, Cost, was a finalist for the NEBA, was named one of the 5 best fiction books of the year by the Washington Post, and received the Fiction Award from the Maine Publishers and Writers Association. Her novel Sparta was named one of the 10 best books of the year by the BBC and won the James Webb Award for Distinguished Fiction from the USMC Heritage Foundation and the Fiction Award from the Maine Publishers and Writers Association. Her fiction has appeared in The Atlantic, The New Yorker, Harper's, Tin House, Best American Short Stories, and elsewhere. Her nonfiction has appeared in The New York Times, The Washington Post, Book Forum, Harper's, and elsewhere. She was twice a finalist for the NBCC Balakian Award for Criticism and has received fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Guggenheim Foundation. She teaches at Hunter College, has twice served on the board of Penn, and is a former president of the Authors Guild, where she continues to serve as a member of the council. Her new novel, Leaving, is out from Norton. Welcome, Roxana. Thank you so much for coming on Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books to discuss Leaving.
I am so thrilled to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Your book is so beautiful, and I am so captivated. The sentences that you write are gorgeous, so much so that as I was walking around New York yesterday, even walking past the entry to a subway station, like the way you wrote about it when you said something like, you know, the sidewalks opened up, and like you just take everything like a simple subway entrance and make it into something poetic and beautiful, which changes how I sort of view the world. So thank you.
Thank you for that. Yeah, that's, I mean, any writer is, you know, because you're a writer and you know what you're trying to do is set down your own experience and make it something you can share. And that sort of illuminates your reader's world, and it illuminates yours. That's why you're trying to transmit it. So it's exciting to hear that it's being transmitted. Thank you.
It's transmission accepted, received. Okay, tell listeners what your book is about, please.
So it's about two people, Sarah and Warren, who had a relationship when they were in college. They split up sort of because of a misunderstanding and just the way those things happen in college. They were quite far apart and things, it fell apart. And they both married other people and really didn't see each other for decades. Then they run into each other by chance at the Metropolitan Opera. And they're both 60, and he's still married to the same woman, and she has been divorced, and her ex-husband died. So she's single, he's not. And everything starts up again. So it's a story about connections between people. It's a love story, but it's also about a different world. I mean, we've all read many, many love stories. I teach Anna Karenina, I teach Emma Bovary. So I love stories, and they're sort of what makes the world function, keep moving as people's attraction to each other. But I hadn't read many love stories that are set in the second half of someone's life. And it's so, so different. I mean, when you're in your 20s, you are a free agent and you can both decide to move to China and learn the language or become, you know, environmentalists. But when you're in your 60s, you have a place. Whatever your life has been, it's there. It's part of you. You have established something. You've established a job and colleagues and friends and a place that you live. And to uproot all of that for someone else becomes very complicated. And you have to measure what you have against what you want. And then there are people around you who may not allow you to be so free. And in this case, they both have adult children. And they realize that their adult children feel that they have a right to play a part in this relationship, which is something really a young person doesn't have. Even if you have kids in there, you know, that are 6 and 8 and 10, they may be furious if you get a divorce, but they can't stop you. But if you have adult children, they can take a very powerful place in your life. So there are all sorts of things that happen in a relationship that takes place in this part of your life that I wasn't seeing written about, and I was seeing it around me, and I thought it was so interesting that I needed to set it down and transmit it.
Wow, really beautiful. Well, not only do you have the love story in the present, but even when you write about it in the past, it seems, you know, it can appeal to people who are used to the, you know, younger love story. You still have all of that. And, you know, even some simple gestures, like when Sarah feels the weight of Warren's body on her and they're like trying to, you know, lean on the couch in a certain way to offset the weight, and just like those little moments are still there. So you still check that box. But there are some discussions, even not even the love story, but even just the dialogue between Warren and Sarah, where they talk about having kids and how before you have kids, your conversations are one way. And then of course, once they're like the power dynamic shifting, like you said, in their involvement, but also in the way they occupy your life and how you're trying to get their attention when they're older as the parent versus the child desperate for your attention as a child, which you had a whole section about that I was just like, yes, this, I kind of want to like, it was just so spot on and well said.
Yeah. Well, children are the big presence in our lives. They're the big other. And we want them, we love them, we love having them in their lives, and they're a tremendous nuisance. You know, whatever you want to do is more difficult if you've got three toddlers hanging on your legs and crying. And so they're part of your life in a wonderful way, and they give you enormous joy, but they also complicate your life. So in the beginning, you're sort of your conversations are about what you're doing as an adult and with your job and your colleagues, but then later and your kids aren't really part of the conversation because you think your real life is elsewhere, is being a professional, whatever you're doing. And then things change and then you start talking about your kids and what they're doing and they take over the conversation. You're so proud of the fact that your child got into Stanford or your child has won an award and they become more and more dominant. And then when you step away from the world, Sarah and Warren are still working, but they no longer are planning to run the world, which they might have done when they were 40. So their children become more and more important. And you realize, then you realize that your children are not paying attention to you, that they are not asking for your attention. So it's wonderful. I mean, I love examining families from every aspect.
You also paint a picture of a single older woman who is totally happy being alone, which is great because I feel like there's this common misperception like, oh no, she's alone, da da da. And you were in this book, you're like, no, 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 this is amazing. Like, I can come in and it's quiet and there's just this beautiful dog and I can do what I want. And you painted like this aspirational setting for the person with the kids hanging off them or anyone else. That's to say, like, we don't need to be surrounded by people to be happy. And there are many different ways that life can look great later in life or really at any stage in life.
Yeah, that was interesting too. I mean, Sarah has a job that she loves, which is working at a museum, and has a place to live that she loves and she's lived in for years, and she loves the natural world around her, and she has this wonderful dog. So she has friends, she has a job, and she has a daughter and a son. So she's very well taken care of by the world around her. Yeah.
I feel like, you know, this might have deeper roots in sort of the societal construct of needing a man. Like, you could take this to a whole feminist place if you wanted, but it, you know, at the least it makes a beautiful setting and a sense of place and all of that. So you were inspired by people in your world. You saw this happening. What happens for you? Because you are not a new author, right? You have a gift of, you know, you can take different scenes and you've been writing. And I want to hear about how you even got into writing to begin with, but when you have that spark of an idea, what is the journey from, oh, maybe I should write about this, to this book coming out? Like, what happens next?
So really, when I write a novel, it's because I've seen or heard something, something has gotten into me that is kind of troubling to me, something I can't understand or I can't lay it to rest. It's something that just stays inside making trouble. And each of my novels has this kind of germ, something that bothers me, that troubles me. And with this book, I remember years ago meeting a couple in Maine at some fundraiser, and I think they were in their 80s, and it became clear that they were a couple, but I knew that he was Mr. McMillan and she was Mrs. Sherman. And I was really shocked. You know, there were these dignified gray-haired people and they were living in sin. And I said, so do you two, and he said, he nodded. He said, we live in sin. We're not married. And it was really surprising. But they seemed, you know, very happy. And they said, you know, our finances are settled. Our kids would be upset if we got married and changed all the legal things. And so we just lived together. And I thought, well, why not? That seems very sensible, but it was really a departure for that kind of person to challenge the norms of society so drastically and to be so happy about it and seem to be minded. And then, so I thought that was really interesting. That was a shift that was going to happen. And really, the two big reasons, practical reasons for marriage, are protecting the children and protecting the inheritance, whatever that is. So that legal commitment is, you know, to make sure that the family money passes on to children and the children are protected, apart from the emotional parts. So these two people didn't have any reason, practical reasons, to get married. And then I just started watching people around me. And I knew something like three couples in New York who would not give up their own apartments. They would move, you know, sometimes they'd stay at his apartment, but they would not give up their own apartments. And that's not something you do in your 20s, really. You want to be together all the time, and you do. So I was just seeing so many different ways of dealing with romance, which was certainly still there. And I remember also seeing, this was a number of years ago, I was at a party in Boston at a club, also very dignified. And I met this woman who was in her gray-haired, in her 80s, and she had this beaming expression on her face. And she said, right over there in that corner is where Bill was standing when I fell in love with him. And I said, oh, that's so wonderful. When was that? And she said, 3 years ago. And I okay. You know, and they were married and they'd been married for 3 years and they were very happy. So I was just getting signals that there was a lot more that I hadn't paid attention to and that was happening around me. So that's how this all started.
And then do you start taking notes or how do you turn that into the manuscript? Do you just start writing? Do you outline? Like, what does the process look like for you?
No outlines, no notes. The only way I can write something is to write my way through it. And I may have a sense of where it's going, but it always changes. So with my first book, my husband was a lawyer and I first showed him the draft of my first novel, or I told him I was writing it. And he said, have you made an outline? And I said, no, do you think I should make an outline? And he said, well, I would make an outline if I were writing a novel. I thought, he's right. I should make an outline. I should write down every chapter and what happens in it. So I did that. I felt really good about myself. I accomplished something. And then I started writing it, but nobody would do what they were meant to. And they wouldn't say what I had planned for them to say, and they wouldn't do anything. So I gave up the outline because for me, it is really an organic process. And I start out with a problem and a set of characters, and their task is to move through that problem and resolve it in whatever ways they can. But I can't. What I need to do, the only preparation I will do is I will often write little tiny biographies of the characters, when they were born, what color their eyes are, where they grew up, what their parents were like, so that I know that character very well. And so that character is consistent throughout the book. This is somebody who's very ambitious and who is impatient and doesn't ever let you finish your sentences. This is somebody who grew up in the country and it's really uncomfortable in the city. So that person, I know that person before I start writing. So I don't end up like Flaubert saying that Emma's eyes are blue on one page and brown on another page, which fascinates all of us. So I need to know the character very well and what kind of actions and what kind of behavior that character will deliver during the book. So that's the only thing I do, so that the characters are consistent throughout. But other than that, I just start writing.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. As kids get older, some things about parenting can get easier. I mean, not many, but some. But others don't, like having conversations about money. Point is, kids won't really know how to manage their money unless they're actually in charge of it, and that is where Greenlight can help. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. Parents can send money to their kids and keep an eye on their kids' spending and saving, while kids and teens build money confidence and lifelong financial literacy skills. With the Greenlight app, kids can learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely, thanks to games that teach money skills in a fun and accessible way. I got Greenlight debit cards for my kids. The greatest thing, you can actually add their photos that take up half the card. So when I handed the cards to the kids, they were like, this is so exciting.
So they look great. Unfortunately, I only put the required 2 cents on at the beginning to make sure they worked. So the kids were like, well, what should I spend my 2 cents on? Anyway, millions of parents and kids are learning about money on Greenlight. It's the easy, convenient way for parents to raise financially smart kids and families to navigate life together. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/Zibby. That's greenlight.com/Zibby to try Greenlight for free. Greenlight.com/Zibby.
And tell me about how you originally got started and how you've kept writing novels a career with your teaching and everything else. Like, just how do you do that? And how did you get started?
I started writing when everybody else does in first grade. It's just, I never stopped. I always loved writing. It was something that made me happy that I could do. And it was something that worked for me. I studied it in college. I studied with Bernard Malamude at Bennington. And after college, I went to work in New York and worked for Sotheby's, which I loved. And that's where I became interested in American art, and which I still write about. And that's why I wrote the biography of Georgia O'Keeffe, because I became so interested in American art. But while I was working at Sotheby's and another gallery, too, I was always writing fiction, and I was trying to get my fiction published. That was really my goal, rather than writing nonfiction, writing art history, which I also did. And then finally, I started publishing. And it's just, you know, as every writer knows, it's just a lot of rejection. You write something and it gets turned down, and you write something else and that gets turned down too. But you just, and I can't tell you how many times I quit writing. Many, many, many times. Okay, if they don't want this story, they don't deserve any more stories from me. I'm not writing stories anymore. And that made me feel very good. I would quit. Then I would think of something I wanted to write about. And so I'd write about that. It was just something, you know, and all writing students need to remember. It's just, there's a lot of rejection. You can't depend on the world to love your work. You have to depend on yourself to love your work. You have to love what you're doing. So that's how it was.
Wow. But when you were doing these pretend quitting things.
They weren't pretend.
They weren't pretend?
Oh, no.
You meant it.
I was really.
Okay. Okay. How long would it last?
Yeah, maybe a week.
Okay. So funny. When you went back to it, did you try something new? Like when you were mad about the stories where you're like, okay, this time I'm going to try blah, blah, blah. No, same thing.
I got enough positive feedback so that I knew that people were interested in what I was doing. And you know, I always wrote about the things that really gripped me. And they were always about personal relationships. And they were always about, you know, intimate connections that went wrong and that had to be resolved. And those things kept coming in my life. I kept seeing them or experiencing them. And I had to set them down. So I just had to do it.
Are there any of your past works that you're like, that you look back on now and you're like, oh, I wish I had changed this about that, or you know, that you have any second thoughts about, or that you're like, I hope I could ever do as good a job as that one.
I never read my stuff again. I would never look at it. It would probably horrify me. I mean, I probably would think, oh, that sentence is bad. On the other hand, when I write, I'm so obsessive. I write every I start, you know, a new file, which is in a new chapter. And so every time I open that chapter, I reread the opening paragraph. So that opening, the opening page of every chapter has probably been rewritten 100 times. Every time I have to go through that. No, this word is too heavy right there. That I have to change that to a 2-syllable word instead of a 3-syllable word. So I everything gets sort of combed through for the tangles. It takes me a long time to get out the tangles. So that's how I function. Mm-hmm. If I went back, there would be some words, but also, you know, my toes would probably curl. I'd probably think that this is a stupid scene or I shouldn't put it in. When my O'Keeffe book was published first by Harper & Row, which was bought by HarperCollins, and then it moved to University Press of New England, and then they went defunct, and another publisher asked me if they could publish it. And I said, sure. And she said, is there anything you want to change, or is there anything you want to add? And I thought, yeah, that book I wrote sort of in the thick of feminism. And there are a lot of feminist passages in it, which I wouldn't put in today. I'm not embarrassed by them, but I could take them out. And I started reading it and I thought, change anything. I would change everything. I would start saying this paragraph should come before that. So I said, I wrote a foreword and I added some letters that had never been published before. So we added new material, but I couldn't go back and start editing. It would drive me crazy. And I never reread my work at all.
Interesting. So how long does a typical book take you? How long did Leaving take you to write?
It's probably the shortest time I've ever spent on a novel. My first novel took me 7 years. The O'Keefe book also took a very short time because there were other people writing the same book and my editor told me that I had to be first. I had a gun to my head. And so if he hadn't said that, I would still be writing that book. I would still be finding more material. But the other books, often because a book turns out to include material that I don't know about and have to do a lot of research. When I wrote Cost, which I thought was going to be very short, I thought it was going to be, it's about a 2-week vacation in Maine, 3 generations of a family. And I thought it was going to be very kind of intense and short and just about those people in that place at that time. And it turned out that one of them was a heroin addict. So all of a sudden I had to learn about the entire world of addiction. I had to talk to heroin addicts. I had to talk to policemen. I had to talk to interventionists and doctors and go to meetings and meet heroin addicts and learn a whole world that I did not know anything about. And the same about my book about Sparta, which is about a Marine lieutenant coming home from Iraq. So I had to learn about Marines, the military, what it was like to be in Iraq, what the Humvees were like inside, everything. So those books took me like 5 years each. This book, I didn't have to do any research for. So I think it took me 3 years.
Wow. And have you started your next book?
Yeah.
Can you say anything about it?
No. I have found, and I think a lot of fiction writers feel this too, if you talk about a book while you're writing it, you lose the intensity that fuels the writing. So I remember early on telling a friend of mine what was going to happen in a book. And I said, and he says this amazing thing. And she says, I can't believe you said that. And I told her the whole scene. And then I got back home the next day and I thought, this is a really boring scene because I had used up all the energy that I had on that scene by telling it. And it was no longer inside me to put down on the page.
Interesting.
So I never talk about the book while I'm writing it. And also, so there's that. I know it's like those indoor, those winter tennis bubbles that depend on keeping the air pumped up. If you let the air out slowly, the whole thing just collapses. So I don't ever let the air out while I'm working on it. And the other thing is that for me, when I'm working on the book, and even the first person who reads it, it's like a cake that's not quite baked. It's still kind of, mm-hmm. you know, rising up and down. It's very, very susceptible to any touch. So if I were to tell you what this new book is about and I saw you frown, I would think it's a really stupid idea. I shouldn't have started this book. That's a bad idea. So any response at all, it has way too much weight for me. When I'm writing the book and when I first show it to somebody, if my agent says, you should, you know, anything my agent says, I listen to, but I am very, very vulnerable when it's not quite finished. I don't want to hear anybody's comment because it will have an enormous amount of weight. And I need to finish it by myself before I show it to anyone.
Well, I'm working on a new book myself, but before I started writing, I was like, running different ideas past people to get a temperature check. Like, what do you think about this? Well, what do you think about this? How about this? And I found very quickly that like one idea was just like way too dark. And people were like, no. And like, it still would have been fun to write. But like, if nobody wants to read it at all, like I could just do that off on my own. Do you know what I mean? I don't know. So I do a little more market testing, I guess. But once I'm getting into it, I'll probably wait. But I don't know. Maybe I don't have as much air in there to begin with.
Well, you pump the air up yourself.
That's funny.
The thing is that talking to your friends about it and saying, what do you think about this idea? You can't give the idea the amount of weight that you would when you actually write it. So you're asking them for their opinion on a shorthand thing that they can't possibly know. They can't possibly understand how you're going to really present it in the book.
Yes, that's true.
You're giving them too much power.
Too much power. Well, I also feel like sometimes by asking it, like if I know what I'm wearing looks good, I'm not going to ask five people for how does it look.
Right.
So if I'm asking people, it's probably not the right thing anyway. Right. Okay. Like I finally arrived at what I'm doing and I don't need to ask anybody about it. Like, but I feel like it's part of how I do it at least. Like, yeah. I guess I need to know that there's something wrong with that. I don't know. Yeah. If I'm like, well, what do you think? Then it's probably bad.
Uh-huh. It drives you, then you should write it.
Yeah.
That's one way to look.
Yeah. Very true. And tell me more about your teaching and how the teaching sort of intersects with the writing and all of that and what you've learned from being a teacher yourself.
I teach my main teaching. I mean, sometimes I teach at a conference or something, but I teach at a Hunter in the MFA program. So it's all writers. And I teach a lit class, actually. It's not a writing class, which is so much fun. And we read Madame Bovary, Anna Karenina, Chekhov, To the Lighthouse. What else? Then there's always one other book that I put in at the end. But we read these great, great books, and the students have mostly never read them before. They want to read them in a group. So there's this wonderful sense of discovery, and people will say, I really wanted to read Madame Bovary, or I really wanted to read Anna Karenina, but I knew I'd never get around to reading it myself. And it's such a delight to read that book. Everyone loves reading it, and it's so absorbing. You get so involved with the characters and the two love stories that are at the heart of it. And you get so involved by Tolstoy's vision, which is vast. I mean, he's trying to figure out how to deal with the Russian continent, as well as his own love life. So it's a feast. And I love the students, and they bring me stories. They have to write one paper, sometimes two, and they can write creative stories in response to the books we've read. And so they tell me stories that I would never have thought of in relation to these books. So it's really a great pleasure for me.
Amazing. What are you reading now for fun?
For fun, I'm reading I just read Anne Enright's wonderful new book, The Wren, The Wren. I love her writing. And I'm going to start reading the Slow Horses series, which are English sort of detective stories that have been made into a TV series called Slow Horses. So those are really fun.
Amazing. I know you've already given advice, but if you had any more parting advice for aspiring authors, what would it be?
Trust yourself. If it's interesting to you, it'll be interesting to your readers. Write what excites you the most, what frightens you the most. Really, the reason that I write books is because I'm disturbed by something. I'm troubled by something, and I can't get it out of my head. And so the way I write about it is to set it down on paper. So write about the things that trouble you the most, and trust yourself. Trust that your ideas are important. Forget about the world. Forget about that devil on your shoulder, which is telling you that it's no good and no one will want it. If you want it, it's good. So just write what you need to write.
I love that. Did you have any other titles for Leaving, or was it always Leaving?
I did have another title for it. I wanted to call it The Other Life.
That's good too. Amazing.
Yeah. Well,
what?
Nothing. It's just that people thought that would suggest some kind of spiritual. Mm-hmm. Which it isn't, but anyway, but Leaving is good.
Leaving is great. Great title. Roxana, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. And again, your writing is so phenomenal and the book is beautiful. So congratulations.
Thanks for having me. I hope you feel better.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram at Zibby Owens and at Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Also sign up for my newsletter at zibbyowens.com and sign up for my virtual book club and meet lots of authors on Zoom every other week. Thanks so much to Steve and Ryan at Texture Sound for the sound editing. And thank you to Morning Moon Productions for providing this fantastic intro and outro music.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.